A dream rescinded today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration is rescinding DACA and giving Congress 6 months to come up with new immigration legislation. Some say it's about time.
President Trump should have ended it on day one. What he has done today actually is provide a soft landing.
But this medical student, who is a DACA recipient, isn't giving up.
I consider America to be my home. This is a place that I grew up. I uphold the American traditions. I am pursuing the American dream.
And in New York, a controversial statue commemorates a physician with links to slavery.
White supremacy doesn't always look like white hoods or Confederate flags or burning crosses. Sometimes it looks like a doctor in a white coat.
Those stories ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to be back with you, everyone. Summer isn't over yet, not technically, but you know this time of year and how it feels. A little maudlin, a new school year, some uncertainty. Today's big news out of Washington, where we start the show today, is about a lot of uncertainty. For people who've benefited from DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the announcement from Attorney General Jeff Sessions today means the future is very unclear.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
The Trump administration says it will be an orderly wind down of the program, with the effects being felt gradually over time. But what's the future if you are a DACA recipient? You likely came here as a kid, undocumented, with your parents, who were also undocumented, and it was only because of DACA that you were able to go to school and work here without legal problems. Julio Ramos fits that description. Just 3 weeks ago, he started med school at the Yikon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Julio is a 24-year-old former biology teacher from Brownsville, Texas, who's long hoped to become a doctor. So that's his dream. Julio joins us from the halls of the med school. And Julio, I gather you've just finished a lab, but I suspect you heard that Attorney General Sessions declared that DACA will be terminated in 6 months. How are you feeling?
It's a lot to process. I started preparing before it even actually happened. But even just now when you played that clip and hearing his voice finally say those words that that program will be rescinded, it just brings a lot of emotions that I thought were already suppressed.
Yeah, no matter how much you anticipated, I guess it is shocking to hear that. So what are you going to do in the short term?
Really, it's just keep going forward. Keep the goal in mind. And that goal in mind for me includes being a physician, but also advocated for the undocumented movement.
Tell us a bit more about your own story, Julio. You got here to the U.S. as a kid. How did you learn you were undocumented?
So I migrated from Mexico, the northern part of Mexico, now 17 years ago. The way that I discovered that I was undocumented was actually in 10th grade. And I was part of the GEAR Up program, which was to promote undergraduate programs so that we could basically attend college. And one of those was to the University of Texas at Austin. And there's a checkpoint 100 miles north of the border. So in order to cross that checkpoint, we had to fill out a form. And in that form, it was asked of us the Social Security number. And then when I went back home and parents were the information, that began the conversation of, we don't have any Social Security numbers. We don't have any documentation papers.
What made you decide to become a doctor?
When I was 12, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was stage 3 breast cancer. And she actually noticed a lump growing on her breast. But the reason that she didn't want to attend the doctor was because we are undocumented, so we don't have insurance. And she wanted to spare us the medical costs. And ever since then, I started looking to the medical field. When I was 12, I enrolled in a magnet program in high school. We did health science technology classes in 9th and 10th grade. And then we did clinical rotations in the hospital in 10th grade. 12th grade, I interned in a rehab clinic. And then I continued my participation in the medical field as a scribe during college. And while I was doing all of that, a lot of my peers were kind of realizing that it wasn't for them. But it was actually the opposite for me. It was just reassuring that this is what I wanted to do. I consider America to be my home. This is a place that I grew up. I learned the language. I'm bilingual. I uphold the American traditions. I am pursuing the American dream.
So your parents, who are undocumented, had hoped to come and see you at a white coat ceremony this month. That's an event for first-year med students who commit to caring for patients. Will they be able to see you?
Since I live below the immigration checkpoint in South Texas, they won't be able to cross the checkpoint, and they won't be able to fly here. So I'll be in the white coat ceremony independently.
How does that make you feel?
Obviously it's a little demoralizing in the sense because it is a tradition and it symbolizes much more than just a white coat, than just a piece of clothing. It signifies your testimony to serve patients, to serve people that you will be working for. And it's something that my family and I have been, it's a family project in a sense where me getting into medical school wasn't solely my efforts. It was the efforts of my family, the people around me that support me. So definitely being by myself will be a little difficult, but hopefully in the end, once I do become a physician, I can just find strength in that my family and I have expressed that we don't necessarily need to be together for them to support my dreams. Although I'll be alone physically, I'm sure that they are supporting me spiritually.
DACA recipient Julio Ramos, he's in his third week of classes at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. We'll let you get back to your lab, Julio. Thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, no problem. Thank you for the opportunity.
Not everyone is outraged by the administration's decision to rescind DACA. There are also people who say getting rid of DACA could pave the way to comprehensive immigration reform. The push for today's move came mostly from a group of state attorneys general who were threatening to sue the federal government if it did not rescind DACA. Mark Krikorian is also a critic of DACA. He's director of the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington. Why do you oppose DACA, Mark?
Well, because it's illegal. There's two separate questions, whether DACA is permissible and separately whether an amnesty for illegal immigrants who grew up here, who came here very young and grew up here, is a good idea. Those are two separate things. To say that we should keep DACA because the beneficiaries of it are sympathetic cases, as in fact they are, is to say that the end justifies the means. And that's never acceptable. DACA is illegal, and President Trump should have ended it on day one. What he has done today actually is provide a soft landing for the DACAs, because the last one would not lose his or her work permit until 2.5 years from now. So this really is, I think, an attempt to let them down easy and to give a grace period of at least 6 months to Congress for them to craft some kind of legislative solution to give a proper lawful amnesty to these young people instead of the illegal one that Obama actually got away with.
So you address several different things there. I want to get to all of them. First of all, you support a legislated amnesty to replace DACA, essentially, if DACA is rescinded.
Yes, I do, although not a freestanding one. It would have to deal with the consequences of any amnesty. So it would have to include both enforcement measures and some legal immigration changes to prevent any of the adults who are responsible for this from benefiting down the road. But yes, in the end, it would be a bill that would, I would support a bill that gave green cards to those people who now have DACA under certain circumstances.
So the end of DACA wouldn't happen until next March, creating, as you said, this window for Congress to come up with some kind of legislation, possibly a comprehensive immigration reform. But do you seriously expect that to happen, given Congress's track record over the last 20-plus years? And immigration reform in particular, despite the urgency, it's been really elusive.
Comprehensive immigration reform is a buzzword for a broader amnesty for all illegal immigrants, with various other measures attached to it. That's not going to happen and shouldn't. What I would suggest for Congress is a targeted measure that does one thing. It's not 1,000 pages long. It does one thing. It legalizes this finite group of roughly 800,000 people who've already been screened by the government to some degree. And as part of that, tries to mitigate the harmful side effects with an enforcement, with an E-Verify requirement, and also by getting rid of some of the family immigration categories that now drive our legal immigration system. You might call it comprehensive immigration reform light or miniature comprehensive immigration reform.
So in the likely event that there is no legislation, as of next March, March 5th next year, about 1,000 DACA recipients each day will revert to being undocumented aliens. What happens to them?
The first thing that won't happen to them is that ICE is not going to have some list and do a dragnet of everybody whose DACA work permits expire. That's a scare tactic. That's just not something. That's not the way. ICE just isn't interested in doing that. They got plenty on their hands. What would happen is, as you said, they would revert to being illegal immigrants. Fact is, they are going to be in limbo. There's no question about it. And this isn't Donald Trump's fault. It's not even really President Obama's fault. It's the result of decades of unwillingness to enforce immigration laws.
Mark Krikorian, Director of the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
One group of U.S. voters that President Trump seems to be able to count on is evangelical Christians. They came out big time for Trump at the polls last November, but many evangelical leaders are not happy with Trump's decision to wind down the DACA program. Here is The World's Matthew Bell.
When Barack Obama started the DACA program back in 2012, evangelical pastor Gabriel Salguero decided to get behind the president's effort.
I supported it from its inception because I felt that we were at a standstill in Congress.
Salguero is based in Florida, and he's the president of the National Latino Evangelical Coalition. 5 years ago, he encouraged undocumented young people to come out of the shadows and sign up with the government program. Why? Because Congress wasn't doing anything to help these young people, Salguero says. The Bible talks about welcoming the stranger, he adds, and that's not all.
These are our brothers and sisters worshiping in our churches, going to our Sunday schools. They're the playmates of our sons and daughters. They're the college roommates of our sons and daughters. And they're also the missionary force of the growth of evangelicalism in America.
Now that President Trump has decided to end the DACA program, Salguero is one of many evangelical leaders calling on Congress to come up with a lasting legal solution for these 800,000 or so young people.
I'm hopeful that now that evangelicals and business leaders and Silicon Valley and some bipartisan voices are lifting their voices in favor of defending DACA, they will move. But the truth is that the historical record shows they've been less than ambivalent. Some have been actually hostile or dragging their feet. So I'm hopeful it's a new day.
Of course, not all evangelicals are on the same page. A group calling itself Evangelicals for Biblical Immigration has published a letter accusing some faith groups of advocating an open borders policy, and it asks Congress to honor American citizens first and foremost.
I don't think anyone's calling for open borders. In fact, I think one of the principles we've been advocating for is for our government to do everything it can do to secure borders.
Jenny Yang is with World Relief, a national evangelical group that works with refugees and immigrants.
We've always supported national security and border security as a core part of a functioning immigration system. I think the real issue has to do with, you know, how do you actually make the immigration system work for Americans and for the future of America, knowing that many immigrants who have come in the past are a core part, not just of our economy, but of our social fabric, especially within the church.
Yang says it's true that President Trump gets the support of many evangelicals, especially white evangelicals, who agree with his stance against abortion, for example. But she says the predicament of dreamers, as DACA recipients are sometimes known, highlights something that a broad swath of evangelicals can also agree on.
Oftentimes in our U.S. laws in general, we don't penalize children for the action of their parents. And I think there's a sense that we need to do everything we can to allow these dreamers to flourish in our country. And so you're seeing just more and more people speaking out on the need to support the DREAM Act and other pieces of legislation like that, in addition to serving them within our church communities as well.
Yang says some evangelical churches have direct experience here. When a member of an immigrant family is deported and relatives stay behind, she says it's often the church that steps in to help out. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Coming up, a New York statue with links to slavery. You're with The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We've seen the anger in Charlottesville, Durham, and other places. And now in New York City, a statue linked to slavery is causing outrage. The monument stands in East Harlem at one of the entrances to Central Park. Activists and community leaders want it removed. The world's Jasmine Garz with our Cross Women's Lives Project has our story, and a warning here. It includes descriptions that some listeners might find disturbing.
Every day, Sashat Mack wakes up and takes this bus to school. She grew up here in Harlem, and every morning the bus drops her off in front of a statue of a man looking down kind of heroically and kind of benevolently at passersby.
Yeah, this has been on my nerves for years.
Sashat can't stand this statue. She's a PhD student in science. She asked me not to say at what school. The statue is of Dr. J. Marion Sims, born in South Carolina. He's considered the father of modern gynecology. He started in the mid-19th century when childbirth was incredibly risky.
So it was pretty dangerous. There also were no antibiotics, the kinds of things we use now to protect women.
Susan Raverby, a historian of medicine at Wellesley College, reminds me that especially in younger women and women who had a lot of children, childbirth often caused an excruciating condition known as fistula, where the vaginal walls tear.
It often leads to, first of all, incredible infections, and second of all, social isolation. They're going to smell. They're going to be uncomfortable. No one's going to want to be around them. It changes their entire life.
Reverby says although any woman could get fistula, slaves were particularly vulnerable.
Because of obviously enforced rape as part of the slave process, very, very young women were often giving birth and weren't given proper care.
Dr. Sims was looking for a way to surgically fix fistula. He convinced slave owners to let him experiment on their slaves with the condition. And donating slaves to medicine was not an unusual thing to do back then.
In 1817, a British medical journal published an article claiming that blacks were so insensitive to pain that you could operate on them with as much impunity as you'd operate on a dog or a cat or a rabbit.
Professor Martin Pernick is a medical historian at the University of Michigan. He's written a lot about the history of racism in anesthesiology.
19th century doctors would have said it's much better to have black women because they're less sensitive.
We know some of the names of those women Sims experimented on. Lucy, who was around 18, Anarka, who was about 14, and Betsy.
Sims is frequently portrayed as this Joseph Mengele Nazi doctor type doing horrible experiments on slaves who can't consent.
Dr. Leonard Wall is a professor of anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis. He's worked with fistula survivors around the world, and he says he knows this for sure. Lucy, Anarka, and Betsy would have been in excruciating pain and desperate for relief when they arrived at Sims' house.
And so I think that these were women who had terrible injuries, that they had deep vested personal interest in having those injuries fixed. That's not the history that's being depicted in the demonstrations against the statues.
Wall is one of J. Marion Sims' more vocal defenders. He says he's seen firsthand how Sims' discoveries helped millions of women in the developing world, even today. Wall also says there are some key pieces of the Sims story people leave out. It's true, he didn't use anesthesia on the slaves he experimented on, but anesthesia would not be widely used or available until a few years later. And in his writings, Sims says he asked the women he experimented on for their consent. But that, the idea that a slave can consent, that is something that baffles activists like Sashat Mack.
If not for the institution of slavery, J. Marion Sims would have been forced to postpone these experiments until the science had caught up, like the science of anesthesia had caught up to his aspirations of curing this surgery. And the fact that there was a population of people who literally had no choice but to consent or but to assent to these surgeries meant that that wasn't something that he had to concern himself with.
Mack is among those who have protested at the site of the statue. They want it removed. The New York City government has responded that it's doing a review of several statues, including this one. Mack says it's frustrating. Every day, it stands here, greeting her on her way to school. The statue of a man who experimented on women who looked like her.
White supremacy doesn't always look like white hoods or Confederate flags or burning crosses. Sometimes it looks like a doctor in a white coat.
Dr. J. Marion Sims finally solved the mystery of how to fix fistula. Silver. After 30 failed gynecological surgical experiments on the slave named Anarka, experiments performed without anesthesia, he discovered silver wire sutures work. He was hailed as a genius of modern medicine. He moved to New York City. He opened America's first hospital for women, presided over the American Medical Association. He took on patients far more illustrious than Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy. In the 1860s, he became the personal gynecologist of Empress Eugenie de Montijo, Napoleon III's wife. He operated on her. By then, he had started using anesthesia. For the World, Jasmine Garst, Harlem, New York.
We just got a new CD in our mailbox here at The World, and with the news today about DACA getting rescinded, it seemed a good moment to spin some of this for you.
If it's gonna go down, it's gonna go down with my people. Con eso, Rebel Diaz, come on.
This is Esso Afrojam Funk Beat from Chicago. Started out there a few years ago as a rotating crew of musicians in the house band for a live music night. Then they established their groove, their reputation, and a regular lineup. And it's that lineup of musicians in a band that is equal parts Afrobeat and Latin American cumbia that says so much about this country. They're from Mexico, Puerto Rico, Ireland, Italy, and Colombia. They're African American and Jewish. They're men and women. And this rap just seems to capture the band's melting pot and this country's. It's called Mi Gente, My People.
Tienes almuerzo, te comparten la mitad. Los míos son de verdad, no se ponen disfraz. No se venden al sistema por un pedazo de pan.
That is the latest from Chicago's Esso Afrojam Funk Beat. It comes out later this week.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says President Obama's DACA program wasn't legal, and that's why the administration is ending it. Some call that ironic, given what Trump recently did for Joe Arpaio.
Rich to hear somebody talking about the rule of law and separation of powers when his boss pardoned a sheriff who defied court orders.
More on DACA still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I mentioned earlier how it's back-to-school time for many kids here in the U.S., and in other parts of the globe, too. But for many Syrian refugee children in Lebanon, school is a distant dream. Instead, tens of thousands of kids are put to work in the fields. The World's Richard Hall has that story.
This is a song the kids sing when they're working in the fields. It's about peace and love and ending suffering. One of the voices you hear is 11-year-old Nora, a refugee from Syria. Every day at 5 a.m., she and her two brothers are woken by their father and sent off to dig potatoes in the burning summer sun.
My brother wakes up first. We eat some bread with oil and thyme and drink some tea. And by the time we get dressed and eat, our ride arrives to take us to the fields.
Nora came to Lebanon with her family from their home in Homs 4 years ago to escape the war there. I meet them in their small tent at an informal refugee camp in the Bekaa Valley, eastern Lebanon. Most Syrians in Lebanon really struggle to get by, and finding work legally is very difficult. Many parents are forced to send their children to work just to survive. Some 180,000 Syrian kids work in Lebanon alone, according to UNICEF. This is not a decision any parent takes lightly. Nora's father, Mohammed, is in tears as he tells me his story. He says he can't work due to a back injury.
In Syria, I used to leave for work in the morning, work hard, earn a living. I used to provide and pay for everything. We came here, and now I just stay at home, wake up the kids in the morning to earn money for bread.
I ask him how it feels to send his kids out like this every day.
How am I supposed to feel? I wish the ground would swallow me up. That would be better for me.
Here in Lebanon, many children work on the streets of Beirut and other cities, selling drinks, flowers, or just begging. Outside of bars and restaurants, and even at traffic lights, you'll come across them, tugging at your sleeves with their hands out. But the majority work in the agricultural sector. In Nora's case, that means potatoes. Lots of potatoes. She and her friends earn about $4 a day. This is Nora's brother, Ahmed. He's very shy. And even though he's not working today, he looks exhausted. Nora, too. He says he has to wear a kind of makeshift apron to carry all the potatoes, and that it hurts his back. Ahmed says we work until we're so tired that we have to sit down. All Syrians in Lebanon are vulnerable to abuse from their employers because they have no legal rights. But these kids are especially so. Nora tells me that her boss is okay, but his brother is mean.
When we stop working or stand still, he scolds us. And once he hit my friend with his bat, and she started crying.
I ask her if the man ever hit her, too. Yes, she says. When I ask her why, she says, we rested for a little while. I wanted to take a look at the fields where the kids work. So we just left Ahmed and Nora, and we're going to go to the field where they work to see if we can see anything going on. We were told not to go too close because the owners wouldn't take too kindly to the press being there. Okay, so we've parked up about 100 metres from where they're collecting the potatoes, and I can see, I'd say, about 24 children, and they appear to be packing bags and throwing them into the back of the truck. It's a boiling hot day, and there's no cover from the sun here. Hearing Ahmed and Nora talk about it's one thing, but it's really shocking to see the kids out there. They're just finishing up for the day. They are too far away to hear, but just like Nora said, they're singing. It's the happiest part of the day, she says. When the work is finished and they're waiting for their ride home, she and her friends play and talk for a few minutes. They can just be kids. For the World, Richard Hall in the Bekaa Valley, Lebanon.
A quick update now to a story we told you about yesterday about Syria's national soccer team and its quest to qualify for the World Cup next year. Syria had a small chance to secure a spot at the tournament if the team could just beat Iran today. But it didn't happen. The match ended in a draw, 2-2. But the dream is not over. The draw was enough to qualify for a playoff spot. So there is still a chance Syria could qualify for the World Cup, despite the civil war there. We'll keep you posted. You may recall a few weeks ago we heard about a practice in some parts of Afghanistan where married women are referred to in public not by their own name but by their husbands, and how some Afghan women were defying that practice. Well, here's a related story out of India. It's about a similar tradition, sort of in reverse. In some parts of rural India, a woman is expected to avoid using her husband's name in public, supposedly a sign of respect. And now there's a campaign to end that practice, one that encourages women to shout their husband's name in public. My BBC colleague Keeta Pandey is in Delhi following the story.
This tradition, nobody seems to know when it originated, where it originated, and why it originated. But all we know is that it has been going on for centuries. Women don't take their husbands' names. They don't call their husbands by their names. And that's essentially because, husbands are supposed to be the ones who provide for you financially. They are also supposed to be older in age. And, you know, so it's a kind of a sign of respect, right? I mean, you know, and in India, husbands are actually treated on a par with God, right? So they are not God's gift to you, but they are actually your gods. So you do not call them by name.
Your husband is a god. That is the attitude. That's pretty extraordinary.
Well, yes, but that's exactly how, you know, it is in the pecking order. And, you know, and this is not something that's just about Hindu religion or any particular religion, because I spoke to my friends and colleagues who are Muslims, who are Christians, who are Sikhs, and who are Jains or Buddhists, right? And it's across the country, it's across the regions, it's across the caste divide. You know, so in families across India, women do not call their husbands by their names.
Yeah, in traditional families, what do women call their husbands?
Well, all sorts of ingenious ways, right? For instance, my parents, right? I mean, they were married for 73 years, you know, until my dad died last year. And she had never, ever called him by his name.
No way.
So, yeah, that is true, right? In front of us, she would call him Babuji, which is the Hindi word for father, right? Which is how we addressed him. But one day I asked her, I said, so what did you call him before we were born, right? Because we weren't there all the time. And you were married to him much before that, right? For many years, you didn't have any children. So what did you call him then? And she said, I just called him Hey-ho, right? Now, Hey-ho is a kind of... Well, hey ho is a Hindi word which actually means hey you.
Right? I was going to say, it sounds like hey you.
It exactly means that, right? But in lots of families, they would say aji sunte ho, which means actually please listen, or will you please listen? Or, you know, or sometimes they'll also call them by the sort of, you know, the father of so and so. So, you know, if your older child is called whatever, right? Munni or Bunti or whatever. So they'll say Bunti ke papa, right? So Bunti's father or Munni's father, right? So that's how they would be addressed.
So now there's this group of volunteers. They've been trying to question this whole tradition, going out, filming women in villages, shouting out their husbands' names. What's been the response?
Well, it's a small campaign, right? Which was done by this group. And they spoke to this group of women and they showed them this little film. And they said, you know, let's challenge patriarchy. And, you know, the first step is you basically have to start taking your husband's names. It was quite funny, but it was also really heartwarming, right? Women were asked to take their husband's names for the first time ever in their lives. And actually, you know, you see the expressions on their faces. It's really priceless, right? Mm. Because some of them are actually quite shy. Some of them burst out into giggles. It was actually quite a strange kind of video.
It also sounds like it could be a very empowering movement, at least for the few people who are taking part in it.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, you know, because some people would say, okay, what's in a name really, right? But the fact is, when I was talking to these women, they said, actually, you know, there's a lot in a name, right? Because it's the very first step towards dismantling patriarchy. If you don't even, if you're not even allowed to call them by their name, right? I mean, you know, how can you think about changing bigger things? I mean, you know, India has a huge issue of discrimination between men and women. And so, you know, the women are saying that, you know, until and unless you challenge the first step, how would you come to the bigger issues?
My colleague at the BBC, Geeta Pandey, joining us from Delhi. Thanks very much for your time, Geeta.
Thank you.
Back to our top story of the day, DACA is on its way out. The Trump administration announced today that it will phase out the Obama-era program. Since 2012, hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children have benefited from the program. They've been protected from deportation and received permits to work legally in the U.S.
I was frustrated and disappointed that Trump has decided to go through with ending the program. It is cruel and unnecessary.
That's immigration attorney Lily Axelrod. She spoke with us from Memphis, Tennessee. In a minute, she'll help us make sense of what's next for the roughly 800,000 DACA recipients in the U.S. But first, her thoughts on today's announcement by the attorney general.
Jeff Sessions talked about the unaccompanied minors who have recently come to the border to request protection from Central America. That's in the last couple of years, folks fleeing violence from gangs and civil strife and Central America. And he perpetuated this myth that DACA somehow incentivized unaccompanied minors to come. DACA protects people, only people who have been here since 2007. And so it has nothing to do with recent arrivals. So I was disappointed to see him attempting to connect those two things. It's also rich to hear somebody talking about the rule of law and separation of powers when he himself perjured himself in front of Congress and his boss pardoned a sheriff who defied court orders. But I was encouraged to see that the Department of Homeland Security has given a pretty long timeline for folks to renew or keep their status.
Yeah, so, I mean, now that you've done a little digging, break it down for us. What will the timeline of this wind down actually look like?
So DACA is going to be slowly phased out over a period of about 2 or 2.5 years. So folks who currently have deferred action and work permits, their current work permits will be valid until the current expiration date. They're not going to be revoked. Those who expire within the next 6 months will have a one-time opportunity to renew, and they may get another 2 years of protection.
So DACA supporters and recipients are hoping that Congress is going to step in and provide some temporary protection or a more permanent path to legalization. If that doesn't happen, some DACA recipients could lose their status as early as March. What advice are you giving to that group of people?
I've been encouraging all DACA recipients, regardless of when their expiration date is, that they need to know and understand what their other options are. Some DACA beneficiaries may be eligible for other forms of protection.
Yeah, what are some of those other options?
Some DACA beneficiaries are eligible for green cards through family members or employers. Some folks already have those applications in the works. Others might be eligible for defenses to removal, including asylum if they fear violence or persecution in their home country, or cancellation of removal, which is for people who have been here for 10 years and can show that their removal would cause extreme hardship to a U.S. citizen, parent, spouse, or child. There are a number of other types of humanitarian protection. So everyone needs to understand their own case and see what they might be eligible for.
There are some people who will continue to receive DACA benefits as late as 2020. What is your advice to that group of people? I mean, the vast majority are in school or they're working. Should they just keep doing that?
Those folks should keep studying, keep working, and keep planning for their future in the United States. They should also see if there is some type of more permanent protection that they're eligible for. And they will also need to participate in the movement to pressure Congress to take action. Those 2 years will pass by fairly quickly, I imagine, and Congress moves slowly.
Now, the thing about DACA recipients is that these are immigrants who are documented, and the federal government knows, for the most part, exactly where to find them. Is that making people more worried that they will be tracked down and taken out of the country?
It certainly is, and a lot of people are very anxious about that right now. The Department of Homeland Security said today that for now, they are not referring all of their information about DACA beneficiaries to ICE. So they're not sending a huge list of people and saying, round these folks up as soon as their protection expires. However, DHS also said that that could change at any time. They're leaving that door open that they could use this information for enforcement purposes. So that is why I'm encouraging folks not to panic, but to know their rights, never to open the door for an ICE official because they almost never have a warrant, and never to speak with an ICE official or answer any questions from them before speaking to an attorney.
That's Lily Axelrod. She's an immigration attorney based in Memphis, Tennessee. We've been hearing a range of reactions today to President Trump's decision to end DACA, the program that protects hundreds of thousands of young, undocumented immigrants, many of whom work in tech. Last week, some of the biggest tech players like Apple and Facebook sent the president a letter urging him to continue the DACA program. Now Silicon Valley is considering its next steps. Tony Rahm is a policy and politics editor at Recode. Just remind us, first of all, Tony, why it's important to the tech world that DACA stays in place.
You know, it matters a great deal to the tech industry to have strong immigration programs in the United States because companies like Apple and Facebook and Google rely pretty extensively on highly skilled foreign engineers. And folks within their ranks are particularly on the DACA program. At Apple, CEO Tim Cook said there were about 250 employees affected by the president's decision. It's a few dozen at Microsoft. It's 11 at Uber. And this is an issue that matters to their families. So the tech industry has been very active on immigration, and it sounded off in staunch opposition to the president's announcement earlier today.
I see that Microsoft and Apple have already pledged to protect their workers who may be affected by this. What are they actually doing?
Microsoft in particular issued a strong statement against the president, and the company said it would work to provide legal aid, including paying the legal bills for some of its employees who are affected by the president's decision. Apple said it would provide some advice to employees who are affected by Trump's decision. And both of those companies are among a much longer list of executives who really want Congress to step in here. Under the plan, there's essentially a six-month delay on enforcement, which gives Congress a very short window to adopt a replacement to DACA. So the likes of Apple and Facebook and Google have all said it's time for Congress to act. And Apple and Microsoft in particular said that they would lobby the U.S. Congress to get it done sooner than later.
Yeah, if Congress doesn't act, though, at the end of the day, what can companies like Microsoft and Apple actually do for their workers? I mean, they can't stop them from getting deported, right?
There's very little probably that they can do. And even with respect to lobbying, those companies might be a little bit powerless. It's not like Apple and Facebook and others haven't tried for many years now to fix U.S. immigration programs and encourage the government to adopt other initiatives that help them hire foreign immigrants. It just really hasn't budged Congress, where partisan divisions have prevented any sort of progress on immigration. This time around, though, there are Republicans who are talking about protecting the Dreamers. Folks like House Speaker Paul Ryan have said that they really want to bring this to a debate in Congress, but whether it can break through at a time when Congress has so much else on its plate is another matter entirely.
You know, it's interesting. You've got Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook and Reid Hoffman from LinkedIn expressing interest getting directly involved in politics and this kind of pushback to the news about DACA. Do you think there's a change of thinking in Silicon Valley when it comes to politics?
There's certainly a change of thinking in Silicon Valley, and it has to do with this administration. You know, 9 months ago, it was hard to get tech executives to talk about Trump. These are CEOs that really don't like talking about politics because they're such divisive issues. They'd much rather focus on the products that they're building. But there's been a lot of pressure from those executives' own employees, the engineers of Silicon Valley, that really want the likes of Mark Zuckerberg and Sundar Pichai at Google and Tim Cook at Apple to sound off whenever Trump does something controversial. So the tone definitely has changed. You're starting to see companies engage the White House more in open political warfare. But whether they can actually shift the president on policy matters is another problem for this industry. Few companies have really been able to shift this president's thinking on policy matters, but the tech industry certainly is trying and certainly spending a lot more money to do so.
Tony Rahm is policy and politics editor at Recode. Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
The news that Trump is winding down DACA is prompting some people to say Canada should take action. Ratna Omidvar is a senator for Ontario. So, Senator, you co-wrote an editorial several months ago arguing that this presents an opportunity for Canada. Just explain that to us. Why should Canada accept deported Dreamers? What's the opportunity?
Well, I hark back to the Vietnam War, when Canada was the intended, so to say, recipient of 40,000 plus draft dodgers who came to Canada to escape proscription to the Vietnam War. And this group has been described as the largest, best educated group of immigrants we've ever had. So here's another chance to, in a way, to write that story. Different narrative, but similar characteristics. People who've been brought up in the United States, who've been to school in the United States, who speak English fluently, who've been to college and university. This is low-hanging fruit for us.
My understanding of the Vietnam War draft dodgers is that they pretty much went on their own volition and found Canada to be a welcoming place. Are we talking possibly a federal legislation to accept the Dreamers who are deported from the U.S.?
We have legislation already that accepts immigrants and also refugees from all over the world. I don't think we need new legislation. What we may need is a short-term, what I would say, tweaking of the numbers, because Canada has a system of defining annual immigration figures, and they sort of roughly vary between 250 to 280,000 people per year. I've argued for a very long time, to no success, I should admit, that these numbers on an annual basis actually constrain us and limit our flexibility. And if we had numbers over 3 years, let's say, then we could respond to situations such as those that the Dreamers And the opportunities such as this one in a more proactive way.
In your heart of hearts, what motivates this whole idea? Is it a moral duty for Canada to welcome these immigrants, or is it sound immigration policy, or is it sound economic policy?
You know, I'm going to be a little personal. I was faced with a decision like this one many, many years ago, where the decision of one government, that was Canada in that case, I was applying for immigration. I was a displaced person from Iran with my family, and it was the decision of one nation, in this case Canada, that would have taken my life one way or another. And I feel for the individuals who are caught up today waiting for this decision and not knowing which way their lives will take. Will they go underground? Will they be allowed to stay? Will they be able to find another place? Or will they ultimately go back to their own countries of origin, if not of birth?
Well, what kind of reaction have you gotten in Canada to your position?
Not much, I would say. There has been no response to a piece that I wrote in the Globe and Mail with a professor from the University of Berkeley, Irene Blomrad. She has written to various parliamentarians, no response. So I think there is no official response.
Do you think this muted reaction has kind of been Canada's polite way of expressing compassion fatigue?
Or a polite way for saying, let's wait and see.
Ratna Omidvar is a senator for Ontario. She says now is the time for Canada to act to take in Dreamers. Senator Omidvar, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
And that'll do it for us today. We send positive vibes tonight to everyone down south who's in the potential path of Hurricane Irma in the coming days. It's a big storm, so be smart and be safe. Marco Werman here from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.